Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I am really excited because we have an author with us, even though he is actually also an educator, because he teaches at Yale and New York University. I have Joshua Rosenblum with me. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, Donald. Thanks for having me on.
He's here because he has written a book called Closer Than Ever, The Unique Six-Decade Songwriting Partnership of Richard Maltby Jr. and David Shire, which I was thrilled that you wrote this, because not only am I a fan of Maltby and Shire, like a lot of theater people are, but also I was thrilled because they are such a kind of, I hate to put it this way, but a mysterious team to a lot of people. A lot of people in theater are so familiar with them and are big fans of theirs. But when you try and explain to people who Maltby and Shire are, they don't understand who they are, and they don't know who they are, especially if they're not really familiar with theater or who any of their songs. But I think the title of the book is excellent, because it the word unique is definitely, when you read the book, you go, yes, unique is exactly the way to describe this partnership, because they have been together, as you say, six decades, which is a really long time. And they're the way they work together. And I love the fact that you get the banter between the two of them that you record in the book is so fun to read, because you can just hear them bantering back and forth, and you see what a perfect partnership these two guys are, because they clearly work so well together, and they've had the most unusual partnership, because they've worked together and then they split up, but not technically split up, but just kind of geographically split up and don't work together for a while. Then they work together, and then they don't work together, and then they work together, and they work on their own projects, and they have separate careers, and then they work together, and they're continuing to work together after so many years. And they're both definitely in their upper years now, but they're still working together and still producing fantastic music. And yet over the years, they've only had two Broadway shows, neither of which would be considered classics, or, you know, ones that people would necessarily know off the top of their heads. And most of their songs that people are familiar with or consider, you know, gems are from two off-Broadway revue shows, which are how they became really well known. So talk to us about your relationship with them, because you do have a relationship with them, which is how you got such great access to them, and how this whole book came about, and how their partnership actually started.
Thanks, Donald. You made a lot of really good points there. I'm particularly pleased that you found them fun to be with, as it were, as you read the book, because I certainly found them that way. And I'm delighted if that aspect of their relationship came off on the page.
Mm-hmm.
I've known them both for a long time, personally and professionally. I think my first encounter with them was when I was a college kid, and I went to play piano for a summer stock theater, and they did Closer Than Ever, which was the first, or sorry, Starting Here, Starting Now, which was the first Maltby Shire review that sort of put them on the map. And I had never heard it before, but I thought, wow, this is really amazing. These songs are just terrific. And the music is sophisticated, but accessible. And the lyrics are really intelligent, but they put you right inside the character, and they're really fun to play. And I thought, and these two guys, they're Yale alumni, and Yale is where I was in college at the time. So they sort of became role models for me at that time. And I was interested in being a composer, lyricist, and I just thought their work was terrific. And then years later, I was fortunate enough to be able to work with both of them. And we were planning, this was right before the pandemic, like 2019, we were planning to put on a concert version of one of their shows that mm-hmm. has never made it to New York. It's called Take Flight. They're
right.
They're about it in the book. But it has never made it to Broadway, even though it's had productions elsewhere. And we were going to do a concert version with me conducting and a cast performing those songs. And we never got to do it because then the pandemic hit. And so I was lying in bed one night in like December 2020. And I said to myself, you know, David and Richard have done all this tremendous work, and they're really beloved by theater people, but the general public is not really aware of them. which is exactly what you were saying a few minutes ago. And I thought, someone really needs to write a book about them. And if I don't do it, nobody is going to do it. So by gosh, I'm going to do it. And I went back to sleep and I woke up in the morning. I said to my wife, I had this crazy idea at 4 a.m. that I should write a book about Richard and David, but you know, why am I going to write a book? She said, no, 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 that's a great idea. You have to do it. So then once my wife said I had to do it, of course I had to do it. So I set my mind to it, and getting published is a whole nother conversation, but I did manage to get the attention of Oxford University Press, who has this Broadway Legacies series that the book was perfect for. And so there it is. And that's how it got done.
And how did, now, go back to talk about how they got together and how they became a team.
Yeah, that's a great story too. They were freshmen at Yale, and Richard had wanted to put on shows in high school, but no one had ever been able to write lyrics. So he wrote lyrics sort of by necessity. And David had always been a composer, and both of their fathers were band leaders by an amazing coincidence. And they met as freshmen, and they didn't particularly like each other. In fact, they sort of disliked each other, but which is very funny when you think about it. But there was nobody else around they could write musicals with. So they started writing musicals together when they were literally 19 years old. And they put on two shows at Yale. One of those shows was called Cyrano. It was an adaptation of the famous Cyrano story. And the first song they wrote for that Cyrano musical was a song called Autumn, which is now one of their most famous songs. Barbra Streisand recorded it. It's in Starting Here, Starting Now. They wrote that song when they were literally 20 years old. And, you know, one of their first songs and one of their most enduring songs. So that's kind of amazing. And they, as you said, their careers have diverged. David went out to Hollywood and he was a successful film composer. Richard has directed a lot of musicals. He directed Ain't Misbehavin' and won a Tony for it. He co-wrote the lyric. He co-wrote the English lyrics to Miss Saigon. And that, of course, was a huge hit without David. But what they most love doing is writing musicals together, and that's what they keep coming back to.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting because the book is structured really, really well, because you follow them chronologically, which you can, and you lay it out really well at the beginning of the book, and you say, I'm going to do this chronologically, and we're going to talk about everything. And I like the way that you hit sort of all of their milestones, whether it's a hit or a miss or whatever. You talk about every show that they wrote together. And then after that you then break down individual important songs from each show and really talk about and give us insight into the structures of the songs and how they were written and why they're important and what it shows you about their songwriting and how the lyrics came about and the changes that were made. And it gives you what I found it really fascinating, because it really does show you a lot about how they work as a team, and you get a lot of, and that was some of the funniest stuff to read anyway, because the way those two work together in terms of how the lyrics come about and who thought of what, and the way these two bicker and they talk about who came up with what idea, it's really funny. I mean, they're like an old couple who,
yeah,
like,
totally.
They're really funny to listen to. I mean, yeah. Even though you can literally hear them in your head, which is what made me laugh so much, is you can literally hear them in your head. But let's talk a little bit about The Sap of Life, because that is sort of, it's a small show that they wrote, an off-Broadway show that was not a success, but it in a lot of ways really launched them, because a lot of it brought them to the notice of some really important people. I mean, Hal Prince saw the show, Sondheim saw the show, Jerry Robbins saw the show, and people came to see the show, even though it wasn't a hit. Their songwriting talents were obviously evident in the score, because people saw the show and took notice.
Yes, for sure. Sondheim saw it like three times. Mm-hmm. And each time he saw it, he came back with and brought one of his starry friends, like, as you mentioned, Hal Prince and Jerome Robbins and Leonard Bernstein. He brought Leonard Bernstein to see it.
Right.
So Richard and David told me they could hardly believe it, like all these luminaries coming to see their show. And Sondheim remembered that show years later and even quoted back lyrics from it to Richard, like, you know, within the last 5 years. Sondheim still had it in his head. And Richard said that was just so amazingly flattering. And no one knows that show today, but some of those songs were extracted and adapted later for use in Starting Here, Starting Now and Closer Than Ever. They're two hit off-Broadway reviews.
Right.
So, watching the Big Parade Go By came from Sap of Life, and She Loves Me Not, and New Life Coming was adapted from a song. It was re-lyricized, but the music and the concept originally came from Sap of Life. So right. Yeah, that's pretty formative for them in a lot of ways.
Right.
And they were lifelong friends of Sondheim, and that was because he had heard that show was so good, and he went to see it, as we said, several times. And they all remained very close.
Beautiful balmy day, everyone's on display, marching, marching, strutting a little and getting the glory. And here on the porch am I, watching the big parade go by. Somebody leads them on, bouncing a big baton, twirling, twirling, tossing and catching it over his shoulder. And oh, does he hold my eye, watching the big parade go by. Look at the people go wild when cavalry 3x3 gives them a sight to see. Doing their drill, proving their skill, thrilling the fella who's watching from up in a tree. Me. After the crowd is gone, often I linger on, waving, waving, keeping the beat of a faraway tempo, but sighing an empty sigh, watching the big parade go by. Watching it from the side. Always there's gotta be somebody watching the show, somebody loving the mummers and letting them know. Any actor's gotta attract applause, those are the laws. They wanna be liked a bit, that's why I'm perfectly glad to be cheering the bands. Millions of people like me gotta fill up the stands. So when the house lights dim, give me a call, and I'll be there giving my all. And when the drums roll out, think about me, there's gotta be me. If I like it, I will cheer it loud and let them hear it. How can there be a parade without a crowd? Probably the music comes, savor a faraway echo, but hearing the music die, watching the big parade go by. Always an empty sigh, watching the big parade go by. Watching the big parade.
And I should tell people that just within the last few years, the cast recording is out on CD.
Oh, you've got it. Wow.
I've got it. Oh, yes, I have it because it came out on Kritzerland, which is Bruce Kimmel's label, because he's very good friends with them. And he got this album. So it's out on Kritzerland. including some bonus tracks with music by David Shire. So
yeah, I found it on YouTube, but I don't have a physical copy. So
I will try and get you a physical copy of the album. So this is the CD. Hopefully Bruce still has, it's a limited edition of 500 pressings, but I will try and get you a copy of the CD. So it's out there if you want to hear the score, because I think he actually remastered it too. So it's actually in good sound. Mm-hmm. So if people do want to hear the score, because it is actually worth listening to, because you can see the talent right from the start, and you can see why it opened doors for them. And then you mentioned it a moment ago with Autumn. Talk about the impact of Barbara Streisand, because it's so funny, because you just have a chapter at the very beginning of the book that is basically Barbara, because of all people, it isn't really ultimately a hit show that, I mean, Sap of Life obviously is important because it brings them to the notice of a lot of people, but Barbara Streisand ultimately ends up playing kind of a major part in their career early on, because she records their songs and they have not had a big Broadway hit or a big anything at this point.
Right. Well, when she started recording songs of theirs, they were nobody.
Yeah.
That was pretty early on. Richard tells me that she recorded Autumn in her first recording session for her first album, although it did not make it onto her first album. It made it onto her fourth album.
Yeah. People, right.
She was churning them out pretty rapidly.
Right.
But she loved it early on. They went to hear her when she was a complete unknown. She mm-hmm. was singing in a New York Greenwich Village nightclub called Bonsoir.
Mm-hmm.
And there was sort of a buzz coming out that there was this young singer and she was going to be the next great chanteuse. And if you were a songwriter, you should get your songs to her. And so they met her then. And then by a stroke of coincidence, David ended up being the pit pianist for Funny Girl,
yeah.
Yes, which was Streisand's big hit Broadway show. And so he had access to her all the time, and he would go up to her dressing room between shows on matinee days and play her songs. And she liked a lot of what she heard, and she recorded a song called Starting Here, Starting Now, which was a big hit for her, and eventually, of course, became the title of their first off-Broadway review. And interesting, David said that he had originally written that for Robert Goulet, and he had
sort of
heard it as kind of a bossa nova. And she, apparently, it turns out the best way to get Barbara to record one of your songs is to tell her that it was written for a man. Because she loves a challenge like that.
Right.
I can do better than any man.
Right.
Say that for a man, give me that song.
Starting here, starting now, when we walk, we'll walk together, year by year. Starting here, starting
the whole Streisand section is really interesting because it not only helps propel their career, but it also gives you a lot of insight into Barbara herself, mm-hmm. because it shows about how in control she was of her career and her song choices. And like you said, when you tell her that the song was written for Goulet and it was written in a certain style, she immediately is interested in recording it her way, and exactly. she wants the song. And of course, the whole story about how David Shire ends up getting into the pit is because she ultimately fires Peter Daniels, who was actually, that's who they were friends with, Peter Daniels, who was her pianist and was music. And the reason she fires him is because he's formed a relationship with Lainey Kazan, who was her understudy.
Right.
And because she's pissed at Lainey Kazan, she ultimately ends up firing Peter Daniels because he's her boyfriend. So
well,
it's,
you've really done your homework there.
I read the book. It's all in the book. So it's just really funny because it kind of gives you not only an insight into Maltby and Shire, but all the different peripheral characters who are floating around them. Is just fascinating to read all the characters who touch their lives. It's just really amazing the stuff that was going on around them.
Yeah. Good. I'm glad you found that entertaining.
It's very fun to, especially because they're at, like you said, at this point, they're really not really anybody. I mean, even this early on, they haven't had a hit show. They're Streisand is recording some of their songs. Starting now, the review has not happened. That's still years down the road for them.
Right, exactly.
And they are friends with Stephen Sondheim, who he's playing for them. He's already done Gypsy and West Side Story, and
right, but no one knows him as a composer yet.
Right, and he's trying out songs from Forum in front of them, and they're plinking out songs of their own so he can hear them, and they're buddies with him. And I talk a little bit about. There's quite a bit of talk about the whole Sondheim influences and imitation. And Richard Maltby has a lot of really interesting comments on that whole thing about people trying to imitate Sondheim or being influenced by Sondheim, and his ultimate revelation as to the whole Sondheim influence thing.
Right. That was a fascinating thing I heard from Richard, which was that... early on, Sondheim had actually been influenced by David Shire, and that mm-hmm. Sondheim had actually stolen chord progressions from David Shire. And mm-hmm. that was very tantalizing to me. And I said, I sort of dug and dug for examples of that. I did come up with one chord progression that Sondheim uses in Ladies Who Lunch that seemed to have occurred earlier in a David Shire song. But you couldn't really hang the whole theory on that one chord progression, I didn't think. So I left it out of the book. Also, I wasn't sure what kind of rights I had to reprint the Sondheim excerpt. And I thought that would probably end up being really expensive. But Maltby said that he heard this from Jonathan Tunick, the orchestrator. Tunick says that there are all these passages in Sondheim that are clearly influenced by David Shire. So I interviewed Jonathan Tunick, whom I'm also well acquainted with. And Tunick said, no, I never said that. I can't think of any examples, so sorry. So that does not appear to be, except for the one chord progression I found, that does not appear to be an actual influence, even though there's tons of mutual respect. And I don't think it works the other way either, particularly.
Right.
I find, although Sondheim's music and Shire's music are both very sophisticated, I think they're sophisticated in very different ways.
Right. And Maltby himself even says when it comes to lyrics, Maltby ultimately just, especially when he was teaching later on, mm-hmm. he just starts to tell students, the only thing you can really do is be yourself.
Yes, exactly. That's the big lesson.
That's the big lesson, is just be yourself, because
don't
there's
try
only
to imitate Steve.
Right. And don't try to imitate anybody, because as a lyricist, you need to be yourself, because there's only one Richard Maltby when it comes to lyrics, and people can tell Richard Maltby lyrics the same way they can tell Stephen Sondheim lyrics. And right. Richard Maltby is not Stephen Sondheim, and right. and he kind of learned that, because I think there's one example where I can't remember what song it is, but there's one example where one of the list songs.
Yeah, I'm a little bit off.
Where you talk about how it almost was too much, and that they started reducing it a little bit, and it actually made the song so much better because they were taking out some of the old extra rhymes in it.
Yeah, exactly. He said, when I wrote that song, I was trying to out Steve Steve.
Right.
You can't out Steve Steve because there's only one Steve. And so he, like you said, he took out some of the internal rhymes, which were really dense, but were in a way inhibiting the meaning. And the less cluttered version was ultimately better, he decided.
Right, exactly, exactly. So then before, because ultimately they, what's so interesting is that it's not as though they're not trying in this period, because this is the 60s. They're definitely trying to write shows. They've got that How Do You Do I Love You show, right, which is very bizarre based on the description. They've got Love Match, which seems like a very, very, I mean, it's got a great team behind it, but it's just, it's a Queen Victoria musical, right, which fails. And then they've got the John Reed project, which ultimately also fails. And then it's at that point, it's when they kind of go their separate ways.
Right.
A little bit after that, which
they actually refer to it as the divorce.
Yeah. But it's not really, it's sort of, I mean, they're still friends. There's no acrimony, sure, really.
No.
It's David gets an offer or interest in going to LA to write for movies and television, ultimately movies, because he gets the conversation with Francis Ford Coppola. Right. Which, even though, you know, the book is going to appeal to, you know, theater people, musical theater people, because it's Maltby and Shire, even the stuff about the film stuff that Shire does is really fascinating, because he goes out to do the conversation with Coppola, and I think he just unsuspectingly ends up stumbling into what turns out to be probably one of the most influential film scores of the 1970s. I mean, The Conversation turns out to be a score that people literally refer back to as one of the best scores of that period.
Right.
It's this, you know, it's the same year as one of the Godfather films, and they're both, you know, both films are nominated for Best Picture, and Coppola directs both of the films. And people go back and look at that kind of sparse, spare score of The Conversation as being really one that people refer, a lot of future film composers go back and refer to The Conversation as one that really inspired them.
Yeah, you're right. It was indeed very influential, partly because it was piano only.
Yeah.
Which is unusual. And in a way, that's, you could think, oh, that's a way to save money and not have to pay for a full orchestra. But Coppola really wanted it that way for artistic reasons, because he thought the spareness of a piano-only score was very good at illuminating the interior life of that character. Harry Call, I believe, mm-hmm, is his name, the Gene Hackman character in The Conversation.
Right. And at this point, because at this point, had he married Talia yet?
He was married to Talia at that point.
Right. Talia Shire, obviously. Right.
Exactly. And that's how we knew Francis.
Right, exactly. And then everything starts to come together back in New York because of Lynn Meadow.
Right.
And it's just so funny that it's this woman who, and she had, of course, had an association with them,
right,
way back.
Exactly. When she was a little girl growing up in New Haven, she, mm-hmm, was cast as one of the kids in their second Yale musical, which was
Grand Tour, right?
Grand Tour. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So Lynn Meadow literally knew them from the time she was 10 years old. She grew up, went to Yale Drama School, moved to New York, and took over at Manhattan Theater Club when it was this foundering small organization. She turned it into a theater powerhouse, which it remains today. And she said, hey, I want to put on an evening of songs by these two great songwriters I knew at Yale, Richard Maltby and David Shire. And that's what turned into Starting Here, Starting Now. And that sort of brought them back together.
In a way, it's kind of interesting because it's sort of a good thing that they had this like series of failed projects in the 60s. Because that's where the songs all came from. And nobody knew those songs because the shows had not gone anywhere. And they had all these songs in the trunk, so to speak. And Maltby really was shepherding the project with Lynn Meadow.
Yes, absolutely. David
was in LA doing film and TV stuff.
Yes, exactly. And he sort of thought, you know, these are songs from failed musicals. Who's going to pay attention?
Exactly.
To that? What a terrible idea, but fine. If that's what you want to do, go ahead.
Right.
Then Richard and Lynn had put it together and said, you've got to fly back and hear what we've got. And David was bowled over. He said, I couldn't believe how great it was.
Right. And even then, and here's the part that I don't think a lot of people realize is that they put the show together and it was two women and a guy, and it ran for a while. Then they moved it, right?
Yes. They ran
and they switched out the guy with another guy.
Yeah.
And it didn't really run a super long time because it was sort of like just barely breaking even.
Right.
But it got good reviews. But the most important thing was that the guy from the record label saw the show and wanted to record it.
Exactly. Yeah, that recording is a terrific recording. It gave the show a long life. And as it happens, it was RCA, I think.
RCA Victor, I think, is the one that did
it. Yeah. So as it happens, the senior vice president at RCA at the time was Thomas E. Shepard, who's now a legendary record producer, had been in a composition class with David Shire at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
Knew David from their student days, thought David was an amazing composer. So at that point, he was an influential executive at a record company. And he said, I want this show recorded. He did not produce it himself. He clarified that for me because for some reason, a lot of people think that Tom Shepard produced that album, but he didn't. But he caused it to be recorded by J. David Sachs.
J. David Sachs, yeah.
Another legendary record producer.
Yep.
So that's how the Starting Here, Starting Now cast album came into being and became.
And it was just a little off Broadway review show.
It was a little off Broadway review in a tiny,
with three people.
Yeah, in literally a restaurant that had a cabaret space upstairs.
Right.
The Barber Ann Theater or Night Spot or something.
Yeah.
Which doesn't exist anymore, but the album endures.
And the album is like legendary. I mean, yeah. It literally is. I mean, I remember when after the album came out, everyone had that album. I mean, I grew up in LA and everyone had that album. Everyone was playing that album to death, even here on the West Coast.
Huh.
Everybody in the theater world out here was playing that album all the time. And it was this little off-Broadway musical review. And it was nominated for a Grammy for Best Musical Album. And the show had closed. I mean, it was a thing of the past.
Right.
And it became this sort of legendary review show.
Yeah.
Everybody knew everybody was like, Maltby and Shire. Who are Maltby and Shire? Who are these guys?
Yeah. Well, that was my experience as a 19-year-old playing in summer stock.
Yeah.
Who are these guys? These guys are great. They went to Yale. I should certainly know about them. I've never heard of them.
Right. Talk a little bit about the songs from the show, because I mean, you go into great depth about I Don't Remember Christmas, because right. That's probably the most well-known song, I think.
Yeah, certainly one of them. The title song is pretty well-known. Autumn, of course, was in that show. Oh, Crossword Puzzle. That's another great number.
Right.
It's funny. That was sort of my wife's signature song when she was in high school. Before I knew her, obviously. We met in college, and I played piano for her when she did a little cabaret, and the first song we did together was Crossword Puzzle, and here we are married all these decades later, and we did the Crossword Puzzle together, so that's sort of that song is a part of our personal history.
I am sitting here doing the Sunday Times crossword puzzle. Somehow the words won't come. I am staring at squares, but my eyes never focus and my mind's feeling strangely numb. What's a five-letter word meaning? Here's an example. Two down, a Peruvian poison dart. Why would Henke and me used to breeze through the puzzle? On Sunday, the answer would leap in my heart. Beast, that's a new GNU. Boop, boop, doo. Where is Hecky now? Ha! He ran off with some floozy on a boat bound for warmer climes. And he left me here doing the crossword puzzle in the Sunday. All the times we had fun here, when more often than not, he'd say, hun, what's a pustule? And I'd say, it's a blot. He'd say, Afghani nomad. And I'd say, it's a curse. could write in the word. And when he was having trouble spelling tryst, T-R-Y-S-T, I showed him, oh, I showed him. 23 across, lover, archaic, amorist, A-M-O-R-I-S-T, blank. I am sitting here doing the Sunday Times crossword puzzle, somehow the words won't come. Can you figure it, me, with my splendid vocabulary? Maybe I should play dumb with the four-letter word, meaning why should it happen to us? There was never a moment's doubt. All at once, heck, he's jumping and screaming and yelling. I tell you, the four-letter words that came out. Prefix, that means pro, P-R-O, bodio, do. Start you feeling as if having brains or intelligence was one of the world's worst crimes. And the sentence is doing the crossword puzzle in the Sunday. All the times, heck, he tell me, you shut up, this I'll get. Seven blanks meaning air hole, it's fistula, I bet. He'd say, don't tell me, it's tubulous, tubuli. I'd say, hecky, it's chimney. Hecky'd sit down and cry. Perhaps that's why I'm left here on the shelf. Perhaps he wanted to get the long ones. 38 across, she carries a torch. Statue of Liberty, S-T-A-T-U-E-O-F-L-I-B-E-R-T-Y-Y-Y-Y-Y-Y-Y-Y-Y-Y. I am sitting here doing the Sunday Times crossword, and I know why the words won't come. 'Cause my mind is miles off on a boat to Bermuda with some ignorant, lousy crowd. What's a five-letter word meaning five major kappa? That's me, I'm as bright as a girl can be. So bright, someone else who could not tell a fig from a frigate is off with my hecky at sea. Bird, that's an auk, A-U-K, auk! If I weren't so dumb, I'd be spending this Sunday in a church hearing wedding chimes. And I'd never remember there was a puzzle in the Sunday Times.
And it's sort of appropriate anyway, because Maltby himself took over doing some of the puzzle stuff that Sondheim was doing.
Yes, indeed. Sondheim introduced the London Times style cryptic puzzles to America at New York Magazine. And when Sondheim got too busy with company to keep doing the cryptics, Maltby took over.
Yeah.
And Maltby to this day does similar style cryptic puzzles for Harper's Magazine. He's been doing that for like 30 years. And they're very hard. I can usually do the Times cryptics that show up on Sunday periodically, but I cannot do Maltby's puzzles.
I'm not going to comment because I have tried and I have failed. So yeah. It's like I just sometimes I can't even imagine the brains that these guys have.
Yeah.
But that's what makes them the lyricists that they are and the writers that they are, because they're just so smart, these guys.
That is certainly true.
The way they can think of this stuff.
Yes, it is funny that Maltby has a song that starts out, I'm sitting here doing the Sunday Times crossword puzzle. that resonates very meaningfully with him as a person.
Right. And so the crazy part, of course, is that, I mean, I think Shire is completely taken off guard, because he, like we said, he's already got his successful career on the West Coast. And now all of a sudden this review show and the album, of course, it doesn't run very long, so nothing really ultimately happens from that. So
right.
Although,
today it gets done all over the world.
But right, at the time, it runs
8 months and closes.
Right, and nothing really happens career wise for them. It's sort of like an album that it takes a while for the legacy of that album to build over time. So he goes back to his film stuff and wins an Oscar for Norma Rae.
Right.
He's nominated for two Best Song Oscars that year and wins
yeah,
for...
Yeah, that was amazing.
And wins for It Goes Like It Goes from Norma Rae, which is a fantastic, it's a gorgeous song.
Ain't no miracle being born. People doing it every day. Grow that way. So it goes like it goes, like the river flows, and tide it rolls right on. And maybe what's good gets a little bit better, and maybe what's bad gets gone. Knows too soon who she is, and bless the hands of a working man. He knows his soul is his. So it goes, like the river flows, and time it rolls right on. And maybe what's good, it's a little bit better, and maybe what's bad gets gone.
At the same time, Maltby is now on the East Coast and he's now directing.
He's now won a Tony.
Wins a Tony for he shepherds Ain't Misbehaving to Broadway, and figures out how to make a revue show work on a Broadway stage and make it captivating for audiences and make it work to the point where it wins Best Musical and he wins a Tony for Best Director, which was a big deal because revue shows had never won Tonys.
Exactly. Historically, like you said, it was the first revue, not a book musical, to win the Best Musical Tony.
Right.
And he then repeated that trick with Fosse, which he also directed, which was also...
Oh, yeah. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to Fosse because that chapter is really interesting.
Oh, good.
That's a very interesting chapter because of all of the amazing personalities and egos involved.
Yeah, wasn't
in
that fun? That was so much fun to work on that.
Oh, I yeah.
To be friendly with Nicole Fosse.
Oh yeah.
To interview her.
Oh yeah. So you now have got them, you know, sort of kind of at the peak of their career, separate careers in a way. I mean, Shire's got an Oscar and Maltby's got his Tony, and they're on separate coasts, and suddenly they give birth to a baby, because baby happens.
Right. Well put.
They have their first Broadway musical.
Yeah. Well, what you find is, in spite of their two separate careers, as we've discussed, what they both really want to do most is write musicals together.
Yeah. Which is what I love about the book, because what comes through in the book, which is what really touched me the most about the book, is that under normal circumstances, when you read about two people like this, you would say to yourself, you know, if I were these two guys, I would kind of say, oh, you know, I would have thrown in the towel. we've tried, we haven't had any success. We've had, oh, Streisand's recorded some of our songs. We seem to do okay writing songs, but we've never had his show on Broadway. But we're both very successful in our separate careers. We're still friends. We still like each other, but let's just move on with our lives. But they don't give up. They still want to write a show together. They still like writing shows.
Yeah, Shire has this great quote where he said, you know, he's written literally over 100 movie and TV scores. He says, I would trade any 15 or 20 of them for a one-hit Broadway show.
And that is like one of my final notes. That's what comes through in the book, is that you know that ultimately, despite everything, all the wonderful things that they've had through these very long careers that they both have had, you can tell in the book that what would ultimately be the capper for them is to just have that one big Broadway hit that they have not had.
Yeah, they were expecting Big to be that quote unquote big hit.
Yeah, well, we're going to get to Big too. Your interviews for the Big chapter were really interesting.
Yeah.
Susan Stroman sounded like she wasn't even working on the same show everybody else was working on.
Well, yeah, there is. You can come away with that conclusion for sure.
Yeah. Because she did. Her memories of the show did not seem to match up with anybody else's memories of the show. But let's talk about Baby real quick, because it's even though the show, I don't think it's a flop. It was in a very busy season. And it's a show that is very beloved. It gets produced all the time.
Yep.
It's a show with a score that people still remember. It's got probably their most famous song. It's got, The Story Goes On is easily their most famous song. It is, and deservedly so. I think it's probably one of the best written musical theater songs ever. And I've always loved it. I even have more appreciation for it after reading your dissection of it in that chapter, because you really explain how the song is written and why it's written a certain way, and that makes it work that much better. And I actually went back to listen to Liz's second recording of it, because I work with Bruce Kimmel a lot, and Bruce produced her solo album where she recorded it again. And I talked to Liz, I was in the studio with her when she recorded it. And she even told me at that point, she said she liked that version of it better than her original Broadway cast, because at that point she'd had a son. She was now a mom. And when she recorded it on the Broadway cast, she was still really young. She'd never been through it. And now as a mom and being older, she had a greater appreciation for the whole thing of being a mother and having a baby. And so she liked her second version better, just because she felt more connected to the song. Both versions are great, but she likes the second one, I think, better, just because she has more connection with it.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I had a book launch event a few weeks ago at Symphony Space here in New York.
Right. I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. And Liz sang that song, and I'm sitting there on stage, like literally right next to her while she is singing that song. And that is quite an amazing experience.
Nobody sings that song like Liz.
Yeah. She pretty much owns it.
And she does.
As she gets older, it has more meaning. It's like, I've said, this song is like a Rorschach test for the maturity of whoever is singing it, because whatever stage they are in life experiences, having a child, and as the child gets older, the song takes on more meaning and see it deepen in meaning as she has sung it progressively throughout her life.
Right. And even it's
3 weeks ago.
It's just so amazingly well written. But Baby, you know, it isn't like the gigantic hit that I think they all hoped it would be, but it certainly has been a long lasting show for them. Mm-hmm. Not as well known, but I did like the fact that you didn't just focus on The Story Goes On. You also, I love that you took apart the ladies singing their song.
Yeah, that's an amazing number.
And talk a little bit about that, because I think it's really fun that you took that apart.
Yeah, that is, it takes us through the experiences of a whole bunch of different women and their feelings about and experiences about their pregnancy. And it's sung from the perspective of Lizzie, who is pregnant herself, and she's talking to all these different women who now have children of their own, but they feel this bond with her because she's now pregnant and about to have the experience that they've all had. But each woman is so carefully and individually etched in terms of the musical style that is assigned to them. It's a whole series of these vivid characters and their vivid musical styles. And it's kind of like a whole cantata. Mm-hmm. With six different movements and six different women. Some of them quite hilarious. And they all feel like they are entitled to touch her stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not really something you want a stranger to do.
Right.
And then she says at the end, this is this great line, we both know soon I'll be singing along, meaning someday I'll be a mom and I will be similarly intrusive to some poor pregnant woman who doesn't want me to come anywhere near her. Mm-hmm. You know, she already understands that pretty soon she's going to be just like them. So I think that is very interesting and self-knowing. But it's musically and structurally, it's just kind of an amazing compilation of all these different women and their experiences of being pregnant.
I go walking and once they're stalking me, the ladies singing their song. My kid showing starts the record going up, the ladies singing their song. I'd say that it's your first, my dear. I'll bet you feel so proud that you could burst, my dear. Now as for me, I couldn't wait to feel again what I felt then. So I had 10. My first kid simply popped out like a cork, my dear. The next they couldn't pry out with a fork, my dear. My third was twins. My fourth I don't remember. Oh no, Beth came first.
Terrible.
punch me. I wish I could ignore him, but we both know that soon they'll number me in the throng of ladies.
It's just not yet fucking Eve.
The ladies. I want to conceive, conceive, conceive. The ladies.
Oh,
and when you join our force, you'll be singing along.
Like I said, that whole section is really a really good example. And I encourage readers when they're reading the book to take your time to go through each of those chapters where you dissect the songs, because it, even though I can't read music, it is really helpful because it does explain and gives you a better appreciation for how Maltby and Shire work.
Oh,
and,
good.
And how, because you don't get too super technical, so that even a person who doesn't read music can really understand what you're talking about and really understands how the songs are put together, because you really do explain it.
Thank you. I'm very happy to hear that, because that was a constant issue throughout the writing of the book, was how do I strike the right balance between including musical examples for people who are really interested in the nitty gritty of the music, but keeping it accessible to people who are definitely theater mavens, but as you said, don't necessarily read music and don't know music theory, are going to be left in the dust by, you know, anything technical or having to do with chord symbols. So it was very important for me to strike that balance so that it would be interesting to both types of people. So if you enjoyed it on that level, I'm very happy.
Yeah, because I have read other books that get a little too technical, and I find myself sometimes flipping pages and skimming past those sections because I'm like, I'm getting lost. So I want to get to the other stuff. But this one, I devoured like every single page of those, because it was just felt really good, because it really was giving me a lot of insight, which I really liked. Good. So the funny part, of course, is that, you know, they come off of Baby and then we get Lynn Meadow again, because good old Lynn is back in the picture, because Manhattan Theater Club wants to do an evening of Urban Blight, where she wants to do another evening of songs. But it's not necessarily exclusively just like Maltby and Shire. It's just like an evening of some sketches and things like that, right?
Yeah. Right. She wanted to put together an evening of, as you said, sketches and songs that have to do with city living.
Right.
And she went, of course, to Richard and David. And they had, by coincidence, been compiling what they called the Urban File, because they wanted to do another Maltby Shire review of songs about city living. So they had like 6 or 7 that were ready to go, and or even more. But she used about that many of theirs in her Urban Blight review. It was another example of, it's originally only going to be one song from each of several different people, but theirs were so good that they ended up using 6 or 7. And that was deemed such a success that they said, hey, let's do a whole review of our own on this topic. And that's what turned into Closer Than Ever.
Right. And then we get another Maltby and Shire review show that becomes a big success, which becomes more famous than their Broadway shows, because it gets a 2 CD set rather than a 1 CD set. And again, becomes one of those albums that everybody's playing, everybody's listening to, everybody's singing the songs in cabaret acts all over the place. People are singing the songs from Closer Than Ever. And again, a whole new generation of theater graduates from colleges are going, who's Maltby and Shire? Who are these? It's like their names are on everybody's lips again. It's Maltby and Shire.
The Closer Than Ever fanatics are a very rabid bunch.
Yes. And there's so many great songs in Closer Than Ever, because they've got songs that were cut from Baby, and they've got songs, all different songs. And I really love that you focused on The Bear, the Tiger, the Hamster, and the Mole.
Yeah, that's a spectacular number.
Because it's like one of the best songs. I think it's one of their best songs, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to agree with that. That was on my recent book launch event. And it was Christiane Knoll sang it. And she sang it in the recent revival of Closer Than Ever. That's incredible. It's like a whole science lesson. It's about this woman who's fed up with men, as a lot of women are. You know, lots of bad dating experiences. But she happens to be a zoologist. She is an expert in the mating habits of animals. And she proceeds to go through animals who pair off in ways that are so natural trouble-free that it makes human mating habits look ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And she just enumerates them one by one as it's in the objective manner of a scientist. I would say it's a classic Maltby and Shire head versus heart number.
Yeah. Yeah.
The intellect versus the emotion. She knows all this stuff, but she can't help falling in love with the bad boys anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And those two forces within her continue to battle it out in verse after verse of fascinating scientific description of the mating habits of animals.
All right, that's it. That's the one that does it. I've had it with that song and dance. A man must this and a woman must that. Two relationships don't stand a chance. I'm sorry to shout, but I'm up to here with all that crap about man and wife. For I, thank God, am a scientist. And I know the real facts of life. Like a soul possessed, I have studied and assessed the creatures of this earth. And from moose to eel, what my studies most reveal is the male's inflated worth. For in most of the animal kingdom, the ladies only seldom need men. Their dealings are straight, they meet them to mate, and never see them again. The bear, the tiger, the hamster, and the females who live fruitful lives outside of male control. For one mindless spasm, they allow the male his role. That's marriage for the tiger, bear, and hamster. Now the mole who's blind will never be confined to one male. She's merely felt. Once his seed is sown, she has her babes alone in the hole where the male mole dwelt. And as for the boa constrictor, she needs no more than one male response. For when it appears, she stores it for years to use whenever she wants. The ray, the rhino, the penguin, and the tern. Those females know that motherhood is not a male concern. Of course, they're not human, but they show what we can learn. They point the way, the rhino, ray, and penguin. In a field or brook, almost anywhere you look, are mothers on their own. In the deep, on high, mothers kiss their mates goodbye and raise their young alone. Now I make no brief for the mantis who decapitates her mate during sex. But I do like the auk who makes with a squawk and then throws rocks at her ex. Ha! The bitch! Woo! The vixen, the queen bee, and the shrew. What men have done to those fine words we never can undo. They're strong working mothers, yes. They're just like me and you. Let's redefine the shrew, the bitch, and vixen. And be like the seagull. Roam free as the lynx. And cruise like the caribous if we choose. And not have to wait for those sly little winks from some man who envies the sex life of minks. And not have to guess if he's one of the finks, or whether he drinks, or whether he stinks, or what he thinks of me. Well, of course, if fate should put upon my plate that quintessential male, I would stick like glue, yes, I would be as true as any beaver, owl, or whale. But till then, I'll envy the oyster who lives a happy life on the shelf. When she wants a term, she releases some sperm and fertilizes herself. The hare, the condor, the guppy, and the bream, they're all out Come march toward the future on my scientific team. For now that you've seen and can compare why anyone with the will to dare can follow the tiger and the bear and hamster.
It's just a wonderful example of how brilliant they're at lyrics these two guys are. I mean, yeah. Mulpey's lyrics are just so good in the song. And it's no wonder that Closer Than Ever has been so enduring. And it was cut from Baby, right?
Yes.
Because it was a character in Baby that was they ultimately cut the character, right? Wasn't that it?
Well, close. The feeling was once she sang the bear, the tiger, the hamster, and the mole, there was nothing she could add to that. Like that summed her up so well and so thoroughly, there was really nowhere else for that character to go.
Right.
So they had to say, this is a great song, but this character starts and finishes with this song. So we can't really put her in the show with the others because the others have these evening long character arcs.
Got it. Okay. Got it.
But it endures as a standalone cabaret number. And it is, as you say, probably one of their standouts.
I mean, and that's one of the great things about them is that when you their songs are so good at telling stories and presenting characters, even just as standalone songs, that they have become staples of cabaret acts all over the place because they're such great cabaret songs because they do give the performer a character to jump into and present a story in just a 3 to 4 minute song. I would say arguably
that is what they are best at and that they are better than anyone else at that.
Yeah.
And that is a possible explanation why there haven't been more hit musicals, because what they're best at really are these songs that are character studies and that stand alone.
Yeah, that's possible. And that brings us to Big, which is, I think, the show that I think everybody had their hopes pinned on.
Right.
That was going to be their big success. And
exactly.
And ultimately, and as you said in your book, there has already been a whole book that was written about the development and production of Big.
Yes, and that is a great book.
It is a very good book
for me. It's very entertaining, and it does a good job of really breaking down that whole process. Although, as Mulpey says, everything in that book is true, but it doesn't quite tell the whole story.
Yeah, and it's a lot about everything that kind of went wrong. And there's a lot that went right. It just, for some reason, it wasn't a bad musical. It just was a good musical at the wrong time. It was kind of out of place. It got hit by things it couldn't control. It got really weird press because of the FAO Schwartz connection, which kind of gave it really weird press that was a little unfounded. And it also was the same season as Rent and all sorts of, you know, it just sort of was like throwback to a different era kind of. And it sort of felt weird at the same on Broadway as a big kind of family musical. And it, in some ways it was, as you said, I can't remember what the title of the chapter was, something like maybe they should have called it Small or maybe should,
yes,
or something
exactly.
Like that. Because I actually saw the national tour of the show and which had been downsized a bit, and it actually worked kind of better, smaller,
yeah,
and more intimate.
As I said, they felt that the national tour version was actually the way they, what they had in mind for it.
Yeah.
It was closer to their original vision.
It kind of felt like it needed to be a more intimate story, and it just ended up getting big, no pun intended, but it ended up getting a little too overblown for what it was. But, you know, and then Stroman of course says, well, of course it got big because it's set in a giant toy store and you've got in New York and you've got like a lot of extras and all these chorus people and big dance numbers. And so of course it's going to have a lot of people on stage with big sets and all this stuff.
And she's right.
I mean, that's the push and pull that's going on stage, is that you've got a very intimate story, but it's set in a very big, gigantic city with a lot of hustle and bustle going on that you can't get away from. So it's pulling you from both sides. And that's kind of maybe why it wasn't working, because I saw the score is not bad.
No, not at all.
But I also like the fact that you zero in on one particular song that was cut from the Broadway production, was right. ultimately recorded, thankfully, for the London production, mm-hmm. Which I have the cast recording for that, which is Little Susan Lawrence, because it's the one song that when it's gone, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because it's the female lead in the show. It's a song for her that helps define her character. And without that song, I mean, I understand why they cut it, because there were too many songs in the scene, supposedly. But Maltby and Shire were not happy that the song was cut, because it's a song that helps soften the character that you need. Otherwise, she comes across as a horrible person. And she's supposed to be the romantic lead. But because there's already, and that is that it's true, that scene has a lot of songs in it. It's a big, long musical scene.
Yeah. That's why Mike Ockren said, we have to cut this. There are just too many songs in this scene.
Yeah. But it's an important song for the character.
Yeah, true. You run into these dilemmas all the time when you're trying to make a musical.
Yeah.
But he was the heavy. He had two huge hits.
Yeah.
He knew how to make a hit musical, and they both deferred to him. And, you know, Wideman says it's still every time Big is redone, like when it's remounted in London or when it was remounted at the York Theater, it comes up every time. You know, mm-hmm. should we put the little Susan Lawrence in here or not? He says it's very strange to be at this stage of the game and still be having that debate.
Little Susan Lawrence, friends with Alice Blue. Teachers had to keep us far apart. So one day Miss Gilmore moved me across the room, right beside the boy who'd steal my heart. He was Buzz Babcock, the very first love of my life. If I close my he always will. In my mind, I mean, where he's always seen, the very first love of my life. Little Susan Lawrence, lovesick little thing. That's the day he gave me a plastic compass ring that whistled and decoded and glowed in the dark. Dear sweet Buzz Babcock, the very first love of my life. In my whole life long, never see his love. On his bike, in a frozen frame, he remains the same, the very first love of mine. I remember everything about that winter, every hour spent beyond the brim. Every day was like a month, every month was like a lifetime, with every waking moment. Though I'm hardly cold, my heart never beat.
and I know somebody who I suspect would prefer not to be identified, but had some involvement in the national tour of Big, where Little Susan Lawrence had been restored. And he said, it just, you're headed toward the end of Act One, and it just interrupts the momentum and just sits there. And it's a great song, but it doesn't advance anything dramatically. And so he's a thumbs down for it. So the debate rages on, but I, as a standalone number, I think it's heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I tear up sometimes when I even think about it.
Unfortunately, well, fortunately for Maltby, sort of, he, you know, after Big doesn't do what they expected, he moves on to Fosse,
right?
Which turns out to be, I mean, he's sort of a director for hire on this thing, because he didn't really develop the show.
No, not at all.
At all. Because wasn't it Chet Walker?
Chet Walker, indeed.
Yeah, who was sort of like the protege of Bob Fosse.
He was a Fosse protege. He had been in lots of original casts of Fosse shows. Right. And he had this idea that there could be this. It's sort of a long development story.
Yeah.
There's a whole chapter on it, as you know.
But it ultimately, by the time the show opens, I mean, you've got Gwen Verdon involved. You've got Anne Reinking involved. You've got Chet Walker involved. And then he sort of gets pushed off to the side.
Yeah.
And he gets
a big blow to him.
Yeah. He sort of gets pushed out of the way. And
it was his brainchild.
Yeah. And you've got Maltby in there, brought in to direct. And, you know, it ultimately opens, and you give a really good assessment as to what works and what doesn't work. And Maltby actually does a really good job of figuring out what's going to work and what's not going to work in terms of how you present a review like this. Cause it is, the biggest issue is you can't just give people these gigantic, huge Bob Fosse dance numbers one after another, cause it isn't going to work. You've got to give them little bits and pieces of stuff, and then you give them a big bang at the end of Act One. You can't just keep giving them gigantic dance numbers one after another, because there's no momentum being built up.
It's exactly. Just, that was Maltby's contribution, is how do we give it an arc?
Yeah.
Review.
Yeah. But ultimately, the show opens and nobody's happy. I mean, it seems like nobody's really happy with what's on stage.
yeah. Well, I mean, I forget how many years it ran. It was a hit.
It was a hit. I mean, because ultimately it was an entertaining, spectacular production that was great for tourists. It was, there was no book to follow. It was just wonderful dancing on stage with a great cast and wonderful songs and great music and very well produced.
Yeah.
I mean, even though you had Garth Drabinsky involved in the beginning, which was
right before he went to prison,
which another interesting omen at the beginning there. But you know, it was an entertaining thing, and it won the Tony for Best Musical, which again was mind boggling. But you know, it ultimately gets up on stage, and you can tell that nobody behind the scenes is 100% happy with what ultimately ended up on stage. They just weren't.
Yeah, I think that may be true. It was a gargantuan undertaking, and it's hard to imagine a perfect version of it. But it was. I mean, I've watched. I didn't see it when it was running because I was working on another show. But it was. I've seen the video of the video capture of the Broadway production, and I just think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. So many great numbers. So much great music.
I saw it here in L.A. before it went to New York.
Uh-huh.
Because I think it tried out here in LA first, and then it was
New York.
I saw it in LA first. Mm-hmm. And it was a big evening of Bob Fosse choreography.
Yeah.
And it was very well put together. Mm-hmm. I mean, it did get a little repetitious in places.
Yeah.
And there were a few moments where you were sort of like, why am I seeing this number? And some of them were, it was hard to make the connection to Fosse. Mm-hmm. In some cases, if you were not 100% familiar with every single thing he had done, you mm-hmm. didn't necessarily know where some of the pieces came from.
Right.
So, because some of them were
logged in the program. But,
yeah, it was. But if you didn't have a chance to look, you couldn't look at your program during the show. So you were like, oh, this is from a TV special. And you were like, you didn't know that necessarily. You're like, I don't know where this is from.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than that, it was perfectly entertaining. You know, great cast.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun.
Yeah, he was really thrown into the fire on that. He was brought in because they felt just as you are saying now, they felt like it, a lot of great numbers, but didn't really add up to a show.
Yeah.
Well, there is the person who knows how to turn a collection of songs into a show is Richard Maltby. So you got to put Richard Maltby in.
Yeah.
But then Gwen Verdon's take on it was, well, who's this guy?
Yeah.
I didn't know the Fosse tradition. I know the Fosse tradition. Chet knows the Fosse tradition. We better bring in Anne Reinking.
Right.
Which means Chet has to go because they'd be doing the same thing. So there's this mess already with Maltby coming in. So I think his greatest accomplishment were his diplomatic skills coming into play.
Yeah, I got that impression.
Being able to corral all these opposing loud and demanding forces that were at play.
Yeah.
So he deserves credit for that as much as anything else.
Yeah, it sounded like just being the peacekeeper and keeping it on course as best he could seemed to be the best thing he was able to do with the show, was to keep it just steering it towards opening night was the most important thing. So then we'll talk kind of briefly about some of the rest of the stuff, because you did mention Take Flight a little earlier, which is sort of a little heartbreaking because it's a wonderful collection of songs. I mean, the score is really, it's an interesting concept. It's, it's Charles Lindbergh, Amelia Earhart, the Wright brothers, all kind of interweaving the whole concept of man's desire to fly. But the difficulty of getting this thing to work makes for a really interesting chapter in the book, because you really kind of go through the whole process of developing it and the difficulty of finding a librettist who could make the show work.
Right. And the feeling was, if John Wideman can't do it, then nobody can do it.
And that's an interesting take, because, you know, Wideman's a fantastic writer, but finding a concept that would work to get the stories to interweave properly seemed like it just was something nobody could tackle.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's so tantalizing because they all feel like a solution is there just out of our reach. Mm-hmm. And I did see Wideman a few weeks ago, and he was talking to Josh Rhodes, who's a up and coming director.
Mm-hmm.
He directed the Spamalot revival.
Right.
And he's very highly regarded. And he and Wideman were having a Take Flight conversation.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know where that's going to lead, but they seemed like they were going to try to make it work again somehow.
Well, he might, because I think Josh Rhodes also directed, I think he did Grand Hotel at Encores.
Oh, I think you're right about that.
And I think, I think he actually did a really good job with it, because Grand Hotel is so imprinted with Tommy Toon,
right,
that people were like, nobody's going to be able to do Grand Hotel without Tommy Toon all over it. And apparently he did such a great job of not doing Tommy Toon that people were like, oh, this could potentially transfer, because it's so, he didn't do Tommy Toon.
Right.
He did his own. And it was so good that people were shocked that somebody was able to reconceive it to make it work.
Yeah.
He might be able to do something with this. Who knows? He's a pretty talented guy.
He is, for sure. I would love to see something come of that, because as you said, it's a great collection of songs. It's some of their best work.
Right.
Although the best show of theirs that has not had a New York production is Waterfall.
That's an interesting story. That's like a really promising thing. I know it played out here at Pasadena, which I did not see.
Yes, exactly.
I didn't see it.
It's undergone a lot of changes since then. It had a big, lavish production in Bangkok.
Right.
That was fall of last year, fall 2023,
mm-hmm.
And it's going to be very difficult and expensive to bring it to New York, but if the right forces come together, that could happen. And that show is beautiful and heartbreaking and multicultural in the best way. And it would just be so wonderful to see that. I saw the video capture of it. It was very impressive, like 7-camera shoot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
You know, edited within an inch of its life, and it just looks and sounds great.
Was it in Thai or was it in English?
No, they sang it in English.
Oh, they sang it in English. Okay.
It had subtitles for the.
Okay.
Or was it the other way around?
Or was it in Thai with English subtitles?
Now I can't remember. No, because I remember the whole thing was the audience was seeing it in their second language, but they were still appreciating it in in to a great degree that okay. everyone found surprising. So it was in it was sung in English with Thai subtitles.
Oh, cool. Okay. Interesting.
And I think when I saw it screened here in New York, they left out the subtitles, obviously.
Okay.
So we just heard it in English.
Yeah, because I mean, you kind of refer or sort of hint at that there seems to be some definite interest with producer wise,
yeah,
potentially with the show.
Yeah, I haven't followed up on that lately, but I should see, because that would be just so spectacular.
That seems like the most promising thing that they've got that they've been working on lately.
I would say it's just impossible not to be deeply moved by it.
Right. Because remind the listeners again, how old are Malpe and Shire right now?
I think they're 86.
86, guys. And they're still working. And they're still working. They're still churning out stuff. And I mean, and amongst the things that we have not even covered, because I'm going to let Joshua go here pretty soon. But amongst the things that we haven't even covered, because there's so much in this book, all of it amazingly interesting, is there's a whole section on, which I thought was so funny to read, was the whole section where you talk about them working with other people. And the fact that Shire writes a musical with Adam Gopnik,
right.
who a lot of people aren't going to know who Adam Gopnik is unless you saw Tar with Cate Blanchett. He's the guy who interviews her at the beginning.
Playing himself.
Right.
It's Adam Gopnik playing Adam Gopnik interviewing.
Which is right. And he wrote a musical with David Shire. And there's this whole section about whether or not Malpe was jealous of them working together. But you also cover Malpe working on Nick and Nora
exactly.
with Charles Strauss and Arthur Lawrence. And of course, Charles Strauss comes across as who Charles Strauss really is, which is this incredibly wonderful person to work with. Everybody loves working with Charles Strauss. He's like the most amazing person to work with. And Arthur Lawrence comes across as Arthur Lawrence, who nobody likes to work with. Nobody liked to work with. Well, he's no longer with us. So we can say nobody liked working with Arthur Lawrence. And if anybody's responsible for the disaster of Nick and Nora, it's Arthur Lawrence. Because I saw Nick and Nora during its 9 performances. Trust me.
Oh, you managed to catch it. Amazing.
I caught, well, like it had like 70 plus previews. But
right. It was in previews forever.
But the only thing that killed it was the book. The score, there was nothing wrong with the score. The talent was up on stage. The book made absolutely no sense. You sat there going, I don't even care. I'll listen to the songs. I'll watch the performers. They're all wonderful. I don't even care who did it because none of it makes any sense anymore. And then you've got the Susatzka musical, another Garth Drabinski thing, which actually it sounds like another wonderful score with a book in a musical that nobody could figure out how to make it work.
Also true. It's really a tragedy. You know, there are half a dozen of them, these great unproduced multi-track
right.
shows.
But again, more material for review number 3.
Yes, exactly.
Which they're planning.
I got to see a tryout run through of it in New York a few weeks ago. In fact, that's where I ran into Weidman and Josh Rhodes talking about Take Flight. But review number 3, which now has the title About Time.
Right, right.
It's funny. I saw the tryout for the tryout. They did a New York run through before they tried it out in New Haven back at Yale for their, I think it was shockingly their 55th class reunion.
Oh, God.
But yeah, so about
that's not, time. And that's a college reunion, not a high school reunion.
Yes, exactly. So About Time, as you said, has songs from Take Flight and from Susatzka and from Waterfall, including some brand new ones. They've written a lot of new stuff for About Time and still developing and polishing it up. But I think that's going to be another beautiful Malpe-Shire review.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. And I think you also made a comment in there that there might be a live cast recording of Susatzka.
They do have a board mix of it from the run of Susatzka in Toronto, which came out quite well. And they're mixing and mastering. And I think they have to get permissions from the cast and the orchestra.
Oh, cool.
But, that's a
wonderful cast. I mean, Victoria Clark is Susatzka. I would love to hear that.
Yeah,
I mean,
she's amazing.
Because she's fantastic. And it sounds like the score is probably really good.
It's wonderful. Yeah, it would be great if the world could hear that. It's a shame. There was some hope that Garth Drabinski might be able to bring it to New York. but he had Paradise Square.
Oh yeah, well, so, which he just lost. He just lost a part of one of his suits or his appeal.
Yeah, just within the last few days.
Yeah,
yeah. So that Paradise Square apparently had a lot of things going for it, but it flopped, and then he had, as you say, a lot of legal issues once again. And so he's sort of been blackballed from New York theater. So there's no versus Oscar under him anyway.
Yeah, unfortunately. But oh well. Anyway, we are pretty much out of time. Okay. But Joshua, it has been a joy talking to you. I cannot recommend this book enough. It is wonderful. It's called Closer Than Ever.
Donald, thank you so much. You're very well informed on all this stuff. I'm impressed you retained so much from the book.
I as I always tell every author who comes on, I read the book cover to cover. I do not read the dust jacket. I read the book. And this one was such a great read because it's like I said, Maltby and Shire are beloved in the theater community, and it's really important for people who are not theater mavens, as you said, to get a better understanding of why and who they are, because they are so important as songwriters, and people should discover more of their work and why they're still so well loved, because they're just so good. And you know, and fingers crossed we get Waterfall on Broadway or a major production of it, because they, again, as you said, and as I was going to close out, you can just tell when you read the book that they would give up their Oscars and Tonys and whatever for that one big Broadway hit, which they never got.
Yeah,
so they really would.
Yeah, they're still plugging.
They're in their 80s and they're still writing musicals, and they are. And I don't know that they haven't even gotten the Lifetime Achievement Award.
Not on the Tonys. They've gotten several. They've been honored over and over by organizations.
Yeah.
New York Theater has the Oscar Hammerstein Award, and the American Songwriters Association just gave them a big award. So just under the surface, they're being honored all over the place.
Right.
It would be nice to see that turn into an honorary Tony. But
that would be. Yeah, yep. Maybe. Anyway. Joshua, thank you so much for taking
my
the time.
My pleasure. And thank you, Donald. Really enjoyed it.
So this is the tale my mother told me. Was much too dull to hold me, and this is the surge and the rush she said would show. Our story goes on. Oh, I was young, I'd forgot that things outlive me. My goal was the kick that life would give me. Joke, something moves to let me know our story goes on, and all these things I feel and more my mother's mother felt and hers before. A chain of life begun upon the shore of sun. Child.